In With Great Pleasure Today, we will, in effect, be offering two ages of the playwright and humorist Alan Bennett. Before hearing his selection of favourite poetry and prose, we thought it might be rather fun to listen to him early on in his career, in 1961, when, in the review Beyond the Fringe, he delivered a famous sermon in a sketch entitled Take a Pew.
First verse of the 14th chapter of the second book of Kings. And he said, "But my brother Esau is an hairy man, but I am a smooth man." Perhaps I might say the same thing in a different way by quoting you those words of that grand old English poet W.E. Henley, who said, "When that one great scorer comes to mark against your name, it matters not who won or lost, but how you played the game." Words very meaningful and significant for us here together tonight. Words we might do very much worse than to consider. And I use this word consider advisedly. Because I'm using it, you see, in its original Greek sense of consider. Of putting oneself in the way of thinking about something. As I was on my way here tonight, I arrived at the station, and by an oversight, I happened to go out by the way one is supposed to come in. And as I was going out, an employee of the railway company hailed me. "Hey, Jack," he shouted, "where do you think you're going?" That, at any rate, was the gist of what he said. But you know, I was grateful to him. Because, you see, he put me in mind of the kind of question I felt I ought to be asking you here tonight. Where do you think you are going? Life, you know, is rather like opening a tin of sardines. We're all of us looking for the key. And I wonder how many of you here tonight have wasted years of your lives looking behind the kitchen dressers of this life for that key. I know I have. Others think they've found the key, don't they? They roll back the lid of the sardine tin of life. They reveal the sardines, the riches of life therein, and they get them out, they enjoy them. But you know, there's always a little bit in the corner you can't get out. I wonder, is there a little bit in the corner of your life? I know there is in mine. And so now, I draw to a close. I want you, when you go out into the world, in times of trouble and sorrow and hopelessness and despair, amid the hurly-burly of modern life, if ever you're tempted to say, "Stop this for a laugh," much time to cast your minds back to the words of my first text to you tonight. But my brother Esau says very well. But I am a smooth man.
Not 40, but 16 years on, in 1977, before an audience in the Dillington House Theatre in Somerset, and in company with Phillida Law, Alan Bennett presented a selection of his favourite poetry and prose, with great pleasure.
I am being entertained. My host sits me down, puts on a record, and says coyly, "I think you're going to like this." I fix on my face an expression of what I hope will pass for appreciation. I even shake my head slowly, as though granted a revelation of such beauty it's unbearable. Meanwhile, he sits back with a look of immense self-satisfaction, watching the spell work what he imagines is its old magic. It can be pre-Columbian flute music. It can be Elton John. Either way, it's a nightmare. And I don't want to do that to you. I'm not saying, with each of these items, you like this. I do. So much as I am the sort of person who likes this. It's a form of self-revelation, even self-indulgence, a bit of a striptease. This was put very well by Kenneth Graham, the author of Wind in the Willows. "You must please remember," he wrote, "that a theme, a thesis, a subject, is in most cases little more than a sort of clothesline on which one pegs a string of ideas, quotations, allusions, and so on. One's mental undergarments of all shapes and sizes, some probably fairly new, but most rather old and patched, and they dance and sway in the breeze and flap and flutter, or hang limp and lifeless. And some are ordinary enough, and some are of a rather private and intimate shape, and rather give the owner away and show up his or her peculiarities." Well, that's my side of it. Phillida Law sums up your side of it in a remark by Florence Nightingale.
"What it is to be read aloud to. The most miserable exercise of the human intellect. It is like lying on one's back with one's hands tied and having liquid poured down one's throat."
Miss Law now administers the first dose in the form of a poem by the Scots poet Norman McCaig. It's called Fetching Cows.
"The black one, last as usual, swings her head and coils a black tongue round a grass tuft. I watch her soft weight come down, her split feet spread. In front, the others swing and slouch. They roll their great Greek eyes and breathe out milky gusts from muzzles black and shiny as wet coal. The collie trots bored at my heels, then plops into the ditch. The sea makes a tired sound that's always stopping, though it never stops. A hay cart squats prick-eared against the sky. Hay breath and milk breath. Far out in the west, the wrecked sun founders, though its colours fly. The collie's bored. There's nothing to control. The black cow is two native carriers bringing its belly home, slung from a pole."
And now, from Georgian Whedon Grossmith's Diary of a Nobody, acute social embarrassment in the Victorian suburbs with that Napoleon of inadequacy, Mr. Pooter. "We found Watney Lodge farther off than we anticipated and only arrived as the clock struck two, both feeling hot and uncomfortable. To make matters worse, a large collie dog pounced forward to receive us. He barked loudly and jumped up at Carrie, covering her light skirt, which she was wearing for the first time, with mud. Teddy Finsworth came out and drove the dog off and apologised. We were shown into the drawing room, which was beautifully decorated. It was full of knick-knacks and some plates hung up on the wall. There were several little wooden milk stools with paintings on them. Also a white wooden banjo painted by one of Mr. Paul Finsworth's nieces. It was a cousin of Teddy's. Mr. Paul Finsworth seemed quite a distinguished-looking elderly gentleman and was most gallant to Carrie. There were a great many watercolours hanging on the walls, mostly different views of India, which were very bright. There was also a large picture in a very handsome frame done in coloured crayons. It looked like a religious subject. I was very much struck with the lace collar. It looked so real. But I unfortunately made the remark that there was something about the expression of the face that was not quite pleasing. It looked pinched. Mr. Finsworth sorrowfully replied, "Yes, the face was done after death, my wife's sister." I felt terribly awkward and bowed apologetically and in a whisper said I hoped I'd not hurt his feelings. We both stood looking at the picture for a few minutes in silence when Mr. Finsworth took out a handkerchief and said, "She was sitting in our garden last summer," and blew his nose violently. He seemed quite affected. So I turned to look at something else and stood in front of a portrait of a jolly-looking, middle-aged gentleman with a red face and straw hat. I said to Mr. Finsworth, "Who is this jovial-looking gentleman? Life doesn't seem to trouble him much." Mr. Finsworth said, "No, it doesn't. He's dead too. My brother." I was absolutely horrified at my own awkwardness. Fortunately, at this moment, Carrie entered with Mrs. Finsworth, who'd taken her upstairs to take off her bonnet and brush her skirt. Teddy said, "Short is late," but at that moment the gentleman referred to arrived, and I was introduced to him by Teddy, who said, "Do you know Mr. Short?" I replied, smiling, that I'd not had that pleasure, but I hoped it would not be long before I knew Mr. Short. He evidently did not see my little joke, although I repeated it twice. I suddenly remembered it was Sunday, and Mr. Short was perhaps very particular. Mr. Poot of England seems to me scarcely more remote than the England of the 1940s. I don't mean the Blitz or Britain Can Take It, bombers droning across sunset skies, so much as the drab, domestic, ordinary England that went on regardless of the war. Barrage balloons were overhead, Italian prisoners of war in the fields, GIs at the local hop, fashion, television, and all our motor cars were in the future. The fabric of the country was untouched, cities shabby but intact, and the English, as it seems now, a people of incredible innocence. If you think of the pop songs of the time, "I've got sixpence, jolly, jolly sixpence. I've got sixpence to last me all my life. I've got tuppence to spend and tuppence to lend and tuppence to send home to my wife." It's practically Hey Nonny No. I like the English painters of that period, first rate but second class, Minton, Keith Vaughan, Ayrton, Carol Waite, and the author of this next extract was a young painter of that time, Denton Welsh. He'd been knocked down by a car in his teens and became an invalid, and in so doing became a writer, and probably a better writer than he would ever have been a painter. He was only 33 when he died in 1948, leaving a handful of novels and a journal that gives a wonderfully atmospheric description of England at that time. Here, he tells how he renovates an old doll's house.
Monday, 26th of March, 1945, 7 o'clock p.m. For the last few weeks, I have been mending a mid-18th century doll's house, which Mrs. Bosanquet of Seal handed over to me in 1941. It has been in her mother's family, Littledale of Yorkshire, since it was made. Mrs. B. said glibly, "I suppose it was made by the estate carpenter." I first saw it in B's cellar on a winter afternoon. She said, "Here's something that might interest you, Denson," and shined a torch into a grey oblong box, amazingly dilapidated, on a stand. There were windows out in it, but I hardly would have believed that it was old until she opened the doors and showed me the charming mantelpieces in each room, everyone subtly different, with perfect mouldings. Then I saw that the tiny doors were two-panelled, and that each room was wainscoted halfway up, just as 18th-century rooms should be. The cellar of Mrs. Bosanquet's house was to be turned into an air-raid shelter for the village, and she didn't know what to do. With a doll's house, she had no room. I volunteered boldly to look after it for her, and she was obviously pleased. It arrived one morning when I was still in bed, having written Maiden Voyage for several hours. My head and eyes were tired, and I was almost trembling with excitement as the men climbed up the outside staircase with it and plumped it down in the middle of the studio. In my pajamas, I began to poke and peer and examine it. First, I tore away all the repulsive curtains and carpets which had been nailed on. The moth's eggs were as thick as a fish roe, and the dust was like bat's fur. Gradually, I emptied every room, dining, drawing, bed, and kitchen. There were only two bits of Georgian furniture left, a charming dark mahogany Pembroke table with one flap, and two tapering legs missing, and a little chest, also very dark mahogany, but quite plain, with little brass knobs. There was a tiny, perfect old brass saucepan, two good pewter cleats, and some little Victorian dish covers. The rest was muck, except perhaps for the curious little chair and chiffonier, perhaps 1880 to 1890. When I'd stripped the rooms, I saw how coated with ugly pink and green paint each delicate moulding was. Even the floors were painted pink and green, perhaps by some child with two pots of bright enamel. Nothing was left, scarcely, of the banisters. The classical pediment that went over the arched central window of the house was luckily in one of the drawers of the stand. Earlier, I had discovered that the drawers of the stand, under thick chocolate paint, were decorated with a Chinese Chippendale fret design in ochre and white, very pretty, but quite ruined by age and stripping. I carefully ruled out the shape of it, then painted nearly all of it in to preserve it. I mended the stand fairly well, then one of the big doors, which was in three pieces. Gradually, I turned to more intricate things, making the missing tapered legs of the Pembroke table, supplying two missing windowsills, the front doorsteps, and the pediment and tops of the columns. The fanlight I made all of matches and putty, and it was good. Then I did more stripping, the top landing to dark blue, the first and original coat, with white mouldings, and the wainscoting in all the rooms. I have now nearly made one of the two chimneys, and am about to begin on the balustrade, which runs along the top of the house, linking up the pediment above the deep cornice. Nothing will look grander than the doll's house, with its perfect classical door, window proportions, heavy Palladian coining, cornice, and then the pediment and the reconstructed balustrade, all standing on the stand, with its fret pattern revived. All these weeks I've been doing it every afternoon after writing in May's garden. One has the feeling that slowly the house is coming to life again.
A story from the notebooks of Samuel Butler. My sister was very ill. Promise me solemnly, I said to her as she lay on what I believed to be her deathbed, if you find in the world beyond the grave that you can communicate with me, that there is some way in which you can make me aware of your continued existence, promise me solemnly you will never, never avail yourself of it. She recovered and never forgave me. When it comes to reading, I'm easily put off. I am put off a book if too many people like it. I am put off a book if some people like it too much. Lewis Carroll is a case in point, Tolkien another, both to some extent picketed by their admirers. I've never managed to read Woodhouse because I'm depressed by the enthusiasm of the people who do. I'm sure this is foolish and a failing on my part, but I'm also sure with books you're more likely to have a love affair with a casual pickup than after an I'm sure you two are going to get on like a house on fire sort of introduction. A book chooses its readers as a play chooses its audience. Fashion has something to do with it, but it's not fashion alone. Somewhere a voice is calling, and if the wrong people respond, it puts me off the author. I don't read his book, I don't see his play. I'm sure this applies to myself too, and indeed, when I sit in the audience at one of my own plays, I often feel that's not where I belong. Had I not written it, I probably shouldn't have gone to see it. The Argentinian writer Borges, I refuse to say Borges, someone else who has a pretty dispiriting fan club, has a very good thing to say about this. He says of a writer, all the books he had ever written filled him only with a complex feeling of repentance. No, one wants to say, that's not what I meant, and in any case, I wasn't really talking to you. W.H. Auden hits the nail on the head. A writer, or at least a poet, is always being asked by people who should know better, whom do you write for? The question is, of course, a silly one, but I can give it a silly answer. Occasionally, I come across a book which I feel has been written especially for me and for me only. Like a jealous lover, I don't want anybody else to hear of it. To have a million such readers, unaware of each other's existence, to be read with passion and never talked about, is the daydream, surely, of every author. Here's a poem by Auden, Musée des Beaux-Arts.
About suffering they were never wrong, the old masters. How well they understood its human position. How it takes place while someone else is eating or opening a window or just walking dully along. How when the aged are reverently, passionately waiting for the miraculous birth, there always must be children who did not specially want it to happen, skating on a pond at the edge of the wood. They never forgot that even the dreadful martyrdom must run its course anyhow in a corner. Some untidy spot where the dogs go on with their doggy life, and the torturer's horse scratches its innocent behind on a tree. In Bruegel's Icarus, for instance, how everything turns away quite leisurely from the disaster. The ploughman may have heard the splash, the forsaken cry, but for him it was not an important failure. The sun shone, as it had to do, on the white legs disappearing into the green water. And the expensive, delicate ship that must have seen something amazing, a boy falling out of the sky, had somewhere to get to. And sailed calmly on.
The public are often more interested in an author's life than in his or her work. Certainly this is true of Virginia Woolf, and perhaps not so surprising since her novels are short on plot and without much humour. Her life, on the other hand, had plenty of both. This is her husband's account of their wedding. Virginia and I were married on Saturday, August the 10th, 1911, at St. Pancras Registry Office, in a room which, in those days, looked down into a cemetery. In the ceremony before a registrar, one makes no promise to love and to cherish till death us do part, according to God's holy ordinance, but in the St. Pancras Office, facing the window, looking through it at the tombstones behind the registrar's head, one was, I suppose, appropriately reminded of the words, till death us do part. Apart from the tombstones, our wedding ceremony was provided with an element of comic relief characteristic of the Stephen family. In the middle of the proceedings, Virginia's sister, Vanessa, interrupted the registrar, saying, "Excuse me interrupting. I have just remembered. We registered my son, he's 2 years old, in the name of Clement, and we now want to change his name to Quentin. Can you tell me what I have to do?" There was a moment of astonished silence in the room as we all looked round sympathetically and saw the serious, slightly puzzled look on Vanessa's face. There was a pause while the registrar stared at her with his mouth open, Then he said severely, "One thing at a time, please, madam." Gwen Raverat, the author of this next extract, was the granddaughter of Charles Darwin and a relation of practically everybody else of intellectual eminence in Cambridge. She had many eccentric relatives, and here is one of them, Aunt Etty.
I have defined ladies as people who did not do things themselves. Aunt Etty was most emphatically such a person. She told me, when she was 86, that she had never made a pot of tea in her life, and that she had never in all her days been out in the dark alone, not even in a cab. And I don't believe she had ever travelled by train without a maid. I'm sure that she had never sewn on a button, and I should guess that she had hardly ever even posted a letter herself. There were always people to do these things for her. In fact, in some ways, she was really very like a royal person. I have been told that when Aunt Etty was 13, the doctor recommended, after she had a low fever, that she should have breakfast in bed for a time. She never got up to breakfast again in all her life. She was always going away to rest in case she might be tired later on in the day or even next day. She would send down to the cook to ask her to count the prune stones left on her plate, as it was very important to know whether she had eaten 3 or 4 prunes for luncheon. She would make Jane, her maid, put a silk handkerchief over her left foot as she lay in bed, because it was that amount colder than her right foot. And when there were colds about, she wore a kind of gas mask of her own invention. It was an ordinary wire kitchen strainer, stuffed with antiseptic cotton wool and tied on like a snout with elastic over her ear. In this, she would receive her visitors and discuss politics in a hollow voice out of her eucalyptus-scented seclusion, oblivious of the fact that they might be struggling with fits of laughter. Aunt Etty was a very fierce anti-Catholic. One evening at Burrows Hill, she attacked me on the subject. I was only about 18 and no match for her vehemence, but I did my duty and stood up to her as well as I could. And my friends could not have been more surprised than I was to find myself defending Catholicism. She began, "If you want a novel to hot you up against the Catholics, I've got a most shocking one here." Me. "Well, I don't really need one just now, thank you. But what's it about, Aunt Etty?" "It's about a priest who rides so fast to give a man absolution that he kills his horse under him. Isn't it horrible?" Me, mildly. "Well, I suppose they believe that absolution matters more than anything else." Aunt Etty, almost unable to speak with indignation. "But doesn't the horse matter? Doesn't cruelty matter?" And so the battle was engaged. The whole evening the unequal contest raged, and I was thankful when at 10 o'clock I was able to escort her up to bed with all her luggage of hot water bottles and bags and books and shawls. By that time I had a headache myself, and I was glad to go to bed too. I was lying peacefully reading and beginning to feel a little calmer when the door burst open and a tiny frail figure in a red dressing gown and a white shawl appeared at the end of my bed. Fixing me with eyes burning out from the deep hollows under her shaggy brows, she began without preamble, "I could swallow the Pope of Rome, but what I cannot swallow is the celibacy of the clergy." Dear Aunt Etty, how easy it is to draw your absurdities. How difficult to show your lovableness. Yet we were all your children, and coming to Burrows Hill was always coming home.
Talking of the relationship between a writer and his readers leads me on to Philip Larkin. I've never met him, but all I've read by and about him leads me to suppose that he's the model of what a writer should be. Diffident and retiring, writing poetry in his spare time, he's reluctant to talk about his work and sceptical of its importance. He cultivates a very English small holding. The poems often set on the outskirts of places, the dead ground where town meets country. It's life as seen from a passing train, Larkin watching the view, shielded by a book against the intrusive conversation of the other passengers. Larkin country is Betjeman country, was Auden country. Factory sports fields lined with poplars, the thin grass next to a housing estate, a spoiled landscape. What sets him apart from Auden and Betjeman is that they just seem to be passing through. They're ever so slightly slumming, with better places to go to and other lives to lead. Not Larkin. This is home, the place where nothing happens. The next poem is called Whits and Weddings, and it's about a journey from Hull to King's Cross in the days of the steam trains. That Whitsun, I was late getting away. Not till about 1:20 on the sunlit Saturday did my three-quarters empty train pull out, all windows down, all cushions hot, all sense of being in a hurry gone. We ran behind the backs of houses, crossed a street of blinding windscreens, smelt the fish dock, thence the river's level drifting breadth began, where sky and Lincolnshire and water meet. All afternoon, through the tall heat that slept for miles inland, a slow and stopping curve southwards we kept. Wide farms went by, short-shadowed cattle, and canals with floatings of industrial froth. A hothouse flashed uniquely. Hedges dipped and rose, and now and then a smell of grass displaced the reek of buttoned carriage cloth, until the next town, new and nondescript, approached with acres of dismantled cars. At first, I didn't notice what a noise the weddings made, each station that we stopped at. Sun destroys the interest of what's happening in the shade, and down the long, cool platforms, whoops and skirls, I took for porters, larking with the males, and went on reading. Once we started, though, we passed them, grinning and pomaded, girls in parodies of fashion, heels and veils, all poised irresolutely, watching us go, as if out on the end of an event, waving goodbye to something that survived it. Struck, I leant more promptly out next time, more curiously, and saw it all again in different terms. The fathers with broad belts under their suits and seamy foreheads, mothers loud and fat, an uncle shouting smut, and then the perms, the nylon gloves and jewellery substitutes, the lemons, mauves and olive ochres that marked off the girls unreally from the rest. Yes, from cafes and banquet halls up yards and bunting-dressed coach party annexes, the wedding days were coming to an end. All down the line, fresh couples climbed aboard. The rest stood round. The last confettis and advice were thrown. And as we moved, each face seemed to define just what it saw departing. Children frowned at something dull. Fathers had never known success so huge and wholly farcical. The women shared the secret like a happy funeral, while girls, gripping their handbags tighter, stared at a religious wounding. Free at last, and loaded with the sum of all they saw, we hurried towards London, shuffling gouts of steam. Now fields were building plots, and poplars cast long shadows over major roads, and for some 50 minutes, which in time would seem just long enough to settle hats and say, "I nearly died," a dozen marriages got under way. They watched the landscape, sitting side by side. An Odeon went past, a cooling tower, and someone running up to bowl. And none thought of the others they would never meet, or how their lives would all contain this hour. I thought of London, spread out in the sun, its postal districts packed like squares of wheat. There we were aimed. As we raced across bright knots of rail, past standing pullmans, walls of blackened moss came close, and it was nearly done, this frail, travelling coincidence. And what it held stood ready to be loosed, with all the power that being changed can give. We slowed again, and as the stiffened brakes took hold, there swelled a sense of falling, like an arrow shower sent out of sight, somewhere becoming rain. And now some Dickens. Mr. Chadband says grace from Bleak House. Here the maid, who had been looking out of the bedroom window, comes rustling and scratching down the little staircase like a popular ghost, and falling flushed into the drawing room, announces that Mr. and Mrs. Chadband have appeared in the court. She is admonished by Mrs. Snagsby not to omit the ceremony of announcement. Much discomposed in her nerves, which were previously in the best order by this threat, she so fearfully mutilates that point of state as to announce, Mr. and Mrs. What's her name? And retires, conscience-stricken, from the presence. Says Mr. Chadband, peace be on this house, on the master thereof, on the mistress thereof, on the young maidens, and on the young men. My friends, why do I wish for peace? What is peace? Is it war? No. Is it strife? No. Is it lovely and gentle and beautiful and pleasant and serene and joyful? Oh, yes. Therefore, my friends, I wish for peace upon you and upon yours. In consequence of Mrs. Snagsby looking deeply edified, Mr. Snagsby thinks it expedient on the whole to say amen, which is well received. Mr. Chadband now stalks to the table and, before taking a chair, lifts up his admonitory hand. My friends, says he, what is this which we now behold as being spread before us? Refreshment. Do we need refreshment then, my friends? We do. And why do we need refreshment, my friends? Because we are but mortal, because we are but sinful, because we are but of the earth, because we are not of the air. Can we fly, my friends? We cannot. Why can we not fly, my friends? Mr. Snagsby, presuming on the success of his last point, ventures to observe in a cheerful and rather knowing tone, no wings. But is immediately frowned down by Mrs. Snagsby. I say, my friends, pursues Mr. Chadband, utterly rejecting and obliterating Mr. Snagsby's suggestion, why can we not fly? Is it because we are calculated to walk? It is. Could we walk, my friends, without strength? We could not. Then from whence, my friends, do we derive the strength that is necessary to our limbs? Is it, says Chadband, glancing over the table, is it from bread in various forms, from butter which is churned from the milk which is yielded unto us by the cow, from the eggs which are laid by the fowl, from ham, from tongue, from sausage, and from such like? It is. Then let us partake of the good things which are set before us. Mr. Chadband was a bore. My favourite bore story is of Lord Randolph Churchill, who was sitting in his club one day and got captured by a very boring member who proceeded to tell him an endless story. It just went on and on and on until Lord Randolph could stand it no longer. He eventually summoned a waiter. He said, waiter, listen to the end of this story for me. Now, Phillida reads Stevie Smith's poem, Not Waving, But Drowning.
Nobody heard him, the dead man, but still he lay moaning. I was much further out than you thought, and not waving, but drowning. Poor chap. He always loved larking, and now he's dead. It must have been too cold for him. His heart gave way, they said. Oh, no. No, no. It was too cold always. Still the dead one lay moaning. I was much too far out all my life. And not waving, but drowning.
There was one period in my life when I spent summer holidays abroad with a group of friends in villas that we rented. I've tried several times to write a play about one such holiday, but I've never managed it. This last poem says it all much better, and it's by one of those friends, Francis Hope, and has an added poignancy in that it was the last poem that he wrote, and he was killed shortly afterwards in the Paris air crash. It's called Goodbye to the Villa Piranha. Prepare the journey north. Smothering feet in unfamiliar socks, sweeping the bedroom free of sound, collecting small change of little worth. Make one last visit to the tip. Did we drink all those bottles? And throw out the unread heavy paperbacks, saving one thriller for the trip. Chill in the morning air, hints like a bad host that we should be going. Time for a final swim, a walk, a last black coffee in the square. If not exactly kings, we were at least franc bourgeois, with the right to our own slice of place and time and pleasure and someone else's things. Leaving the palace and its park, we take our common place along the road as summer joins the queue of other summers, driving towards the dark. Literature, it seems to me, is waiting, each one of us in our own lives, to be delivered by someone who really knows us. Or again, as Auden says, follow poet, follow right, to the bottom of the night. With your unconstraining voice, still persuade us to rejoice. In the desert of the heart, let the healing fountain start. In the prison of his days, teach the free man how to praise. A fairly serious note on which to end, but that's something I'm always being told off for. I start off with jokes and then drift into melancholy. So I'll end with a story which combines both. It's about Dr. Routh, the 19th century president of Magdalen College, Oxford. He was president for 63 years and lived until he was 100. A frail little nut of a man, he was late on in his 90s when one of the fellows of the college hanged himself. The other fellows were very worried, knowing that they would have to break the news to Routh, but fearful lest the shock should kill him. At length, one was deputed to approach him, which he did very nervously. Mr. President, I'm sorry to have to tell you that one of the fellows has committed suicide. Don't tell me, said Ralph. I want a guess.
With Great Pleasure was presented by Alan Bennett in company with Phillida Law. The producer from Bristol was Brian Patton.